We produce ridiculous challenges that, you know, put your back up against the wall and hopefully make you a better person.
Let's go.
Welcome to Citizen. We've got a special guest today, Joe DeSena. You created something that I think a lot of our people would recognize, and that is the Spartan race. But you did a couple things before that as well, right? So first, give us a brief introduction, and then we'll jump into some of your background.
Yeah, sure. Joe DeSena here, CEO and founder of Spartan. We produce ridiculous challenges that, you know, put your back up against the wall and hopefully make you a better person. I grew up in Queens and New York many, many years ago. I'm 54. Happy to get into that if you'd like.
Yeah, I mean, so you grew up in Queens when it was a working class town, right?
Grew up in organized crime capital of the world.
Yeah.
If you saw Goodfellas, it was ground zero for that movie.
And how was that? I mean, do you still live in New York now?
I don't live in New York now. We have a farm up in Vermont, and I shuttle between Vermont and Florida. My wife pulled the plug on Vermont. She's now here in Florida with the kids, and we've got them in a school. She thinks, you know, it's good to have them in a normal setting where they can do sports and stuff. But most of their life, we were up in Vermont chopping wood and taking cold showers and skiing. Let's go back to Queens. Queens was a crazy place. It was, you know, it was energized. There were a lot of people, whether they were doing good or bad, they were up early in the morning. And if you didn't have a hustle, if you didn't have that extra step in your, you know, when you were walking, if you didn't have that kick, you were left behind. And so I got sucked up into that and that energy. And it made me who I am. I think if I had grown up around a bunch of great basketball players, then I would have attempted to be a basketball, right? Whoever you grow up around, that environment shapes your life. So for me, it was action, hard work, and don't complain about anything. Just deal with it.
Yeah. I mean, it's that hustler attitude, you know, I feel like it gets, some people feel like it's intrinsically bad, right? But it's just one form of motivation. It's, you know, applied correctly, I don't think you could make the case that it's bad. I mean, you were kind of an entrepreneur from a very young age, right?
Yeah, I can't see if it's bad. I mean, I guess there are probably a bunch of people out there that would prefer everybody to just be a little slower and dumber. And, you know, I'm not a conspiracy guy, but like, I don't know. You'd probably rather be around a bunch of hustlers or around a bunch of people that just work hard, have high energy. Who wants to be around people that don't have energy, that aren't like exciting you to do something? I remember convincing my friends at a young age to play hooky because we were going to dig up a park and create a BMX track. And when I reflect back on it now, although it was terrible and my father got yelled at and I got yelled at, you can't do that. I think it was exciting that I was able to excite these kids to create something that day. Does that make sense?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I mean, it's, I don't know. I appreciate your wife's perspective on wanting a semi-normal childhood school experience because of the socialization part. But I also think to some stuff that Elon Musk has said about how, you know, and to your point, we do tend to teach the lowest common denominator because it's a corporal form of teaching, right? I mean, it's an assembly line, which is not really, that's certainly not the most efficient, or it may be the most efficient, but it's not the best way to educate people. And I think his idea was we should teach to the level of the individual student. Now, you can't teach each student individually, but you can promote them ahead of their peers and stuff. And I 100%, if you put like a 10-year-old in a classroom with a bunch of 16-year-olds, that's going to be a problem socially. we've seen that with kids that go to university too early, but there is something to that, right? I mean, they make some attempt with the honors classes and stuff like that, but even I was in those classes when I was in middle and high school, and they were boring as shit.
You know, it's interesting. I've never heard it said the way you just said it, which I got in Queens, the 9 and 10 and 11 year olds, we were hanging out on the street with the 16 year olds. Mm-hmm. And so we were getting educated at that level. When I look at my kids now, my oldest is 18. I feel like I was there at 13. Mm. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I agree with that. I was actually having a conversation with somebody about this the other day about, this is my opinion. It's been my experience. It's been the experience of my friends. And I've seen the inverse of it, both in my later years in the military and now as somebody who's a leader and sees young kids, you know, kind of going through it these days. I think you mature at the age you are required to mature, right? And delaying that process doesn't do society any favors, and it doesn't do the individual any favors either, frankly. Like, exposing them to like more and more responsibility and stress into their early to late teen years, I think, is a really important part of becoming an adult. And it's the reason people are living at home until 25 to 30 now and not doing some of the stuff that we did when we were younger.
Yeah, and it's a tough challenge, because if you and I were able to snap our fingers and say, okay, we all agree it's better, let's push the kids at a younger age, let's expose them at a younger age. The problem is the devices. The device, it makes it very, very challenging because it's so addictive. I see it in my house. I have a lot of kids in my house, not just my own, but everybody seems to hang out there from the neighborhood, and they are just staring at the device.
In the same room with each other, staring at devices, right?
It's crazy, and I'm a crazy parent. And I'm fighting with them, and I tackled my son last night, and we're fighting over the phone. My daughter, like, it's a problem.
So how do you remedy that? I mean, obviously, we were kind of latchkey kids, right? Like, our parents were working, so we had to go out into the woods and play and take some risk and shit like that. It just kind of developed naturally. And you've sort of, not just entrepreneurially speaking, but with Spartan especially, made kind of a career out of, what is this, like, intentional suffering, if you want to call it that, I guess. We're having a really hard time replicating that onto this new generation and a half or two generations.
Yeah, I look, again, I'm doing some unique things that we don't see around the world, making the kids carry kettlebells a couple of miles, having them climb mountains, run marathons at 8 years old, like, even with all that stuff that, you know, anybody listening is saying, this guy's a crazy person, my kids are still, as I just described, staring at these phones. So how do we change it nationally, globally? How do we do that? You're going to have to get together with the device makers, which will never get done. If I had my way, if you had your way, right? It would be so simple, because this thing is so addictive, because it's basically infected everybody. It can be used to do what we want, which is, it just goes black unless the kid does 30 burpees. It goes black until they snap a picture of eating a salad. It goes black unless they take, you know, a math test or another language test. Like, you could use this to level up the kids, but instead it's going in the other direction.
I haven't seen that app yet.
No, that doesn't exist.
I mean, that seems like it would be pretty easy to program, even if it was just like activity through an Apple Watch or some whatever other watches there are. Or, you know, there are plenty of gamified, like, math and science apps now for kids and for adults as well, language software and all this stuff. We just, nobody's made that next step into tying it into the entertainment. And I think not just leveling the kid up, but establishing the relationship between effort and outcome, effort and reward, is a very good lesson to learn in those formative years as well. And we've kind of, these days, it's so easy to get some French fries and an iPad and be like, hey, stop crying here, just shut the fuck up. You know what I mean? And it's sometimes you got to let them go through it, right?
It's hard because, you know, if you don't have the phone in the house, if the kids don't have the phone, then the feeling is, well, everybody's got a phone and they don't have a phone, and that's a little weird. I was in the living room with the kids on Sunday. They got done wrestling, and one of their friends was over, and he carried over an Xbox and attempted to plug it in, and they were gonna, and I took it and I threw it on the porch. But you could only do that so many times before your house and your kids become the weird ones.
Yeah, you're Luddites now, right?
Yeah, exactly. During the summer, I'm lucky, we have something called Death Camp we put on the farm in Vermont. And I get about 100 kids from around the world with open-minded parents. And I'll take their phones for 2 weeks straight, which is awesome. But that's only 2 weeks. Mm. You know, I started a new thing on Thanksgiving, no phones on holidays. So that's another couple of days. But yeah, I'd love, I mean, schools, by the way, schools should, you should have to hand in your phone in the morning when you walk, do 30 burpees, hand in your phone, take a quick cold shower, and then get ready for school.
What do you think happened to that in public education? I know a lot of stuff, like people do have these conspiratorial ideas a lot, and some of them are true. Like the idea that public education is an assembly line to create, you know, non-disruptive, docile employees. There's no question, because Rockefeller, Ford, all the people that set the education system up in the early part of the 20th century said that specifically. But we had the presidential physical fitness test that was run by Arnold Schwarzenegger for a while, right? We had all these, we had dodgeball. I mean, when I was in high school, middle and high school, we had to do things. We had to run a mile, whatever, right? I can't figure out why that has evaporated from the curriculum, other than maybe just safetyism. I don't know what it is exactly, but I don't think there's anything conspiratorial. I think it's just incompetence, to be honest.
Yeah, I think what happens when I look at my own, I had to give a speech recently to some folks at Norwich University. It's the oldest private military college. And I had their board there. I had their alumni, their large donors. And I said, you know, Norwich is very similar to Spartan, right? We started with these wild ideas where we're going to train people, we're going to put them through hell, and we're going to make them better in the process. But I would imagine, not knowing Norwich very well, but knowing Spartan, that you have to make compromises along the way, tiny little compromises like, hey, Joe, we could no longer have the gladiators at the finish line because that's too dangerous. Hey, Joe, the insurance company wants to change this. Hey, Joe, this sponsor said this, right? And you start making these little seemingly insignificant compromises along the way to make it scalable, like public education, mm-hmm. to make it safe, to make sure people stop complaining. And you wake up one day and you're like, this is not what we started. How the hell did this happen? And so, look, I'm sure there were some parents complaining about PE. I'm sure some finance folks were complaining about PE. I'm sure the insurance folks were complaining about, like, and then you get rid of PE and you wake up, you know, 30 years later, and we've got a big problem.
That's a big mistake. It's a huge no-no in business, right? To scale beyond your capacity or beyond your purview or beyond your total addressable market or whatever, right? Like I've seen businesses do this before and completely collapse. It's like, oh, we've got 2% market share now. Imagine what we could do with 6. Let's get enough inventory for 6. And like, well, you don't have that market, bro. It's like that doesn't exist. So now you're fucked. But what generally happens is when production capabilities and total addressable market intersect, at some point there's a diminishing return, right? Always. Whether like we had this problem with some of our optics in the military back in the day. They started mass producing them because civilians wanted to buy them now, right? So instead of making 13 or 14,000 a year, now they're making like 60,000 a year, and we're having to send them back because they're fucked up all the time. We're doing that with our kids. We're doing this with education. Like this seems pretty important to make sure that the next generation is going to be okay and able to take care of themselves. And everybody wants to talk shit about Gen Z and all this, but I mean, if anything, we failed these people. It's hard to blame them.
Well, what's interesting is I've lived around the world. We moved from the farm as we were building Spartan and attempting to scale. We had a moment in time in our family where we could go live in Singapore for a year and Tokyo for a year and China for a moment. And We lived in Vancouver, and we were in different schools all along the way. And so I've got the purview of seeing a lot of different school systems. And I will tell you, it's not that it can't be done. You can have education that performs, an educational system that performs, checks all the boxes that you and I would be proud of, but it's just not being done for the masses. It's being done for the few. We're in a school now. I'm so, luck. We're so lucky that to be part of. We just found it randomly here in Florida, and it was run by an admiral. It's got very, very tight rules. It's got lots of PE. It really celebrates sports. And they do one thing that's amazing, that if every school did this, it would change everything, which is all day long, as my four kids are in that school and they're handing in their homework, I see real time how they did on that homework. Did they get a 2 out of 10? Did they get a 10 out of 10? Where did they stand with their? So real time, when they get home, we can have a discussion and solve the issue rather than finding out a quarter or half the year later that they haven't even been going to class. So there are, there is technology today, and we again, I've seen amazing educational systems that work. And we got plenty of money as a country. I mean, we throw it around in all kinds of places. Why don't we just use a little here? It seems important to me. I mean, if I had my way, here's another one I would do. If I had my way, and I think you'd agree with this, every kid in that last year of high school or maybe a gap year, maybe every kid in America would have to do 1 year of military service. Now, it doesn't have to be that they're deployed. I'm not suggesting that. What I'm suggesting is they get all the benefits, the discipline, the knowledge, the ability to, I don't know, repair a vehicle, put together a weapon. Like, there's some simple basic things that every kid should learn in a highly disciplined or like that makes sense to me. By the way, that's another, there's another. Now, people are going to be pissed off when I say this, but you could easily, the military machine is a big machine. And you could make arguments about things where, places where they fail, but they're highly successful in a lot of areas. Why not take some of that knowledge and some of that machine and, I don't know, infuse it into schools? That's what I would do.
Yeah, I mean the discipline part is certainly something that's lacking. And what discipline really allows for, it's not people think about it in this very, fatalistic for its own sake discipline, because discipline, it's almost tautology, like you're appealing to it for its own sake. But the reality is what discipline allows for is more decentralized control over a unit, whatever it happens to be, whether it's in the military or whether it is like your sales team or whatever the fuck, right? What it really allows for is everyone's on the same page, following the same rules, performing the same activities with the same standard. So the unit itself becomes plug and play. The leadership, the middle management inside of that leadership also becomes plug and play. It becomes consistent and repeatable, which is really important. And what it also allows is for the manager, the top level managers, to let the middle managers take more risk, right? In that controlled environment, because things are so disciplined, intrinsically there's a safety net there. And this is the same thing with in the social sphere. If your kids are disciplined and they make good decisions, they take risks but not stupid ones, then go walk to school, right? You're not dumb. Do that. And then that kid is empowered to make better and better decisions as life goes on, because they've actually put they've tested their mettle to some degree, right? I think that the foreign language requirement in high school should be removed. And that's typically 4 semesters. I think those should all be some kind of service, whether it's community service or civil service or military service. If they want to go to basic training their junior year, a lot of people do that, and just do that'll satisfy that requirement. And I think language should be moved to elementary school, where it fucking belongs. When kids actually, when the soft palate begins to form, because there's no way they're learning the language correctly when they're learning it at 16 to 30, to 25 years old in high school and college. It just doesn't work that way. You know what I mean?
That makes a lot of sense. Our children, we were lucky, and anybody listening, like There are amazing apps out there. If you start at a young age and those kids, again, because they're addicted to the phone, engage, forcefully engage, at least it was that way in our household, in using those apps every single day, they become fluent in a language very quickly.
Oh, yeah, and it's cheap too. Like one of our sponsors is Babbel. It's like, I think $9 a month or something like that. And you like all the kids can use the same account. You could learn, teach them whatever language you want, right? They have like 30 languages on there or some shit. It makes a lot more sense to do that from ages, I would say 4 to 12 is where you should really start that process, depending on the kid. Trying to pick up a foreign language with all the other stuff going on in high school at 14 to 18, that's shit, it's not gonna happen, man. I mean, how many, what did you remember anything you learned in a foreign language class in high school? Because I sure as shit don't. I mean, what a
I did.
total waste of time, but that was 4 semesters, right? That's 2 years of your life, basically, that an hour and a half, three times a week was dedicated to this completely pointless activity. That's a lot of time to just waste like that. When you could be, learning some real life skills, like you get a semester credit, 3 credits or whatever it is for going to a soup kitchen and seeing what real poverty looks like. So when you get out into the real world, you're not like, oh, woe is me, my life sucks. Like, no, actually, you're in the top 1% of the world right now, buddy. Because most of the world lives on $1.75 or less per day.
I couldn't agree more. I'm with you. A guy said to me recently, he said, "You know the problem with my kid?" I said, "No, what's the problem?" He said, "My 5-car garage." He's right.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned the tech that's available. It didn't used to be like that. You're absolutely right. It used to be like like kids like me, for example, would say, "Oh, everything's good," until the report card came, and my dad's like, "Everything is not good. Clearly, you haven't been doing anything." The tech exists now, but the difference today is that you still have to engage as a parent, right? Like I know plenty of people who have access to this tech to review their kids' homework every day, and they don't do it. I was working in politics in California back in the day, maybe, let's see, 12 years ago. We did this research study about educational outcomes, right, for all possible demographics. So gender, race, ethnicity, nationality, whether they were an immigrant or not. Social class, and then household income. The number one predictor of academic success was parental involvement. It was the only one that outshined everything else. There were poor kids who were doing well, there were rich kids who were doing poorly, so on and so forth. Every race you would see, it was just dots all over the place. Except for when it came to, I can't remember the exact questions, but one of them was, do you review your child's homework?
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Once a week or more was one of the questions, and that is up in the 80th percentile of academic performance. It's the only one that was up that high.
And it makes sense. And the software that I described helps make that even easier. So as a parent, whether you have time or no longer an excuse, right? easier to lean in. Yeah, we were crazy. My wife and I were crazy people at a young age. They were doing. I had met two very, very successful kids, brothers, on Wall Street. They did very well on Wall Street, and I was always intrigued as to find out how they grew up, how they were parented, so that I could apply some of that to our household. And this one kid said to me, my mom used to make me do the next year's work each summer. And I thought, makes perfect sense. I mean, there's plenty of time during the summer, especially when you're looking at them staring at devices. And so we started doing that. We started getting ahead of the next year, and it really changed the game. And it requires a parent to lean in. By the way, I must have had 3,700 fights at minimum to get them to do their Mandarin on their phone every day. It was a battle every single day, and requires work as a parent.
How do you adjudicate that argument? I mean, what happens when they just start screaming at you in Mandarin? You know what I mean? I guess you win technically because they know the damn language.
Yeah, no, they speak the language. They're fluent. It was either do it or you lose your phone. Right, the phone is so powerful, you can get everything you want out of them. If the risk is that they're going to lose their phone, we at death camp one year, I had a soft moment, and I gave them back their phones for an hour to call their parents, and I gave them ice cream. Two things that I would never do, but I was doing it. It was not a study. I wasn't planning on this. All the ice cream melted because the phone was so much more important to them. They didn't even go get the ice cream. That shows you how addictive the phones are.
There's something really sinister about that, not intentionally, but an outcome, because we do crave that socialization, right? We want to be, we're communal creatures. We want to be around each other. That's why we build civilizations, to protect that and scale that ability to be social and amongst each other. And, you know, there are physiological effects from that, right? Good ones rather than poor ones. So, you know, death scrolling on your phone or playing some little fucking game is giving you plenty of dopamine, but what's it doing for your serotonin and melatonin? You know what I mean? Like, and then you combine that with all the gut health issues that people have these days, where most of the serotonin's made. And it's no wonder, like, we are seeing depression on a scale now, depression, mental health, and suicidal ideation and attempts, even among some of the more historically resilient groups, like teenage girls, right, are starting to see problems with this, I know that show, what the fuck was it called? That Netflix show.
I can't remember
what it was. I can't remember the name of it, but I know the main character that was a female, but historically speaking, that's usually a young male being violent or being suicidal, not a female, right? I think that was just Netflix, doing their woke thing. But it is becoming true. I think teenage girls are the fastest growing subset of suicidal ideation and attempts now, right? So even the more resilient groups are getting touched by this stuff now. And there's plenty of factors, right? Like, our hormones are all fucked up. There's all kinds of shit going on. But this lack of direct human interaction and contact with one another, and not just the contact itself, but the pursuit of it and the things that we build in pursuit of it, like women build good intersocial skills, men build creative skills like building shit and learning to protect people. These historically very important skills are now being lost. We're becoming weaker.
I was at one of our races this weekend. It's going to sound self-serving and promotional, so I don't mean it to. And lately, when I go to our events, I have a camera and I'm just asking people, tell me your story. How'd you end up here? And the stories are so unbelievable. Just yesterday, a woman lost her kid, lost her best friend, started drinking, really dark place, marriage falling apart, finds the races and turns everything around. And I've got thousands, tens of hundreds of thousands of those stories, and you scratch your head and you're like, I don't understand. I just build some obstacles. I put some flagging, some barbed wire. How could it be that this profoundly changes so many lives? And it's for the reasons you said, right? They're coming together. It's basically church. They're coming together. There's sunlight. It's forcing them to put down the drink, put down the cookie, go to bed early. They're losing some weight so they feel good. They're starting to pay attention to what they eat. Phone doesn't do that.
No. No, it's all the second and third order effects of having to do those things that, you know, have developed us evolutionarily over the last couple hundred thousand years, right? Like I've got to be, you know, this amount of strong or this amount of clever or whatever it is to be able to perform in society. Otherwise I get left behind. And I'm sure you've seen some of this stuff is so obvious. It's so obvious that it boggles the mind almost. I mean, it's the only thing I can really say is that these devices have way more control than even we can admit now, frankly, because I'm sure you've seen this data, but just walking at a brisk pace for 11 minutes a day, that's 10 minutes plus one, reduces the chance of heart disease by over 50%, right? Just walking for 11 minutes a day. Like, you can't take your lunch break and eat it while you're walking around the building a couple times. 11 minutes a day, and you will reduce the risk of heart disease by 50%. Meanwhile, 38% of Americans are either diabetic or in pre-diabetes, right? Type 2. It's like we're on fire, and there's an oil drum and a water drum, and we just keep going. That oil drum looks pretty good, and let's go check that out. Like, I don't understand how.
I give a great analogy. I say, imagine if you walked into your house. First of all, let's agree that we're animals. You're an animal. Mm-hmm. I'm an animal. We could wear sweatshirts and hats and have microphones and screens in front of us. At the end of the day, we're animals. You walk into your house and your dog, another animal, is sitting on the couch, smoking a cigarette. She's painted her nails. She's having a drink. She's scrolling on her, like, that would be a pretty weird scene. But somehow that's how we're living.
It is pretty bizarre. I mean, and it was kind of a trope in the 80s and 90s. Like, okay, we're all comfortable now. And all these people are trying to go back out to nature and camp and hike and all this bullshit now. It's like, what are you doing? Thought we were done with that. Like, well, maybe there was a purpose for all that stuff, right? So you've what was it that made you decide to start Spartan?
Well, let's go way back. So
okay.
My parents get divorced. I'm like 11 years old. I'm in Queens. I want to level up like these guys that have rolls of $100 bills in their pocket. You know, how do I make money? My neighbor, who's the head of the banana organized crime family, says, hey, come over to my house on Saturday. You're going to clean my swimming pool. So I go over there, show up at 8 a.m. He says, Joe, I'm going to teach you a couple of lessons. Pretty bizarre coming from a mob boss. But he says, on time is late. You're supposed to be here at 8. You get here at 7:45. Number two, if you're going to clean the pool, which I'm paying you for, you should also straighten up the shed, the lawn furniture, clean the windows, stuff I'm not paying you for. Make yourself invaluable. And then number three, never ask for money. You'll get paid if you do a good job. So anyway, those things stuck with me, and I was a hustler, and they needed somebody they could trust in their backyards. And before you know it, I built it to about 700 customers.
Wow.
I made a lot of, it was a big business. I made a lot of mistakes along the way, but eventually we were doing concrete work and brick work and rebuilding houses and putting in windows. And I really felt like I had made it, you know, and all my customers were talked about, were whispered about everywhere. So I was getting to hang out with all those guys. And then I learned about Wall Street. I graduated college. I was still running my business. And I learned about this place on the other side of the river called Wall Street. And there were a lot of people making a lot of money there. So I sold my business to the guys that worked for me. They were immigrants. This is interesting because I had hired over the years building that business, lots of kids from the neighborhood, but none of them had the work ethic I needed. Mm. And then I stumbled upon some Polish immigrants. These guys were unbelievable. I mean, They showed up before me. They stayed later than me. If we got in at 11 o'clock at night working, they stayed an extra hour and cleaned the truck. They just wanted more hours. They never asked for a day off. It was like having robots. It was awesome. And so that's the level that I wanted to play at. Those are the kind of people I wanted to be around. But anyway, when I sold the business, I sold it to them. They're multimillionaires now. They've done incredibly well 30 plus years later. And I went to Wall Street and I fumbled around and I learned something really interesting because I didn't know anything about finance at the time. I knew how to run my business. And because I didn't know anything, because I had a really creative outlook on things, I saw some stuff that others didn't see while I was sitting on a trading desk. I was working on the New York Stock Exchange and I was able to start my own company there and with a slightly different twist that folks that were properly trained did not see. And it worked. And it worked in a big way. And while I was running that business and building that business on Wall Street, I, as a way to remain sane and feel healthy and alive, because I felt great when I was cleaning pools and mixing cement and laying brick and doing physical labor in sunlight and sweating every day. I felt great. I didn't feel so great under fluorescent lights in front of a screen all day getting yelled at. I found adventure racing. I found these crazy races all over the world. The Iditarod in Alaska. And so I did all these races and I felt alive and I started roping people in. I would lie to people to come do them with me. And they were incredibly transformative, incredibly addictive.
You're like tricking your friends into coming to this bullet, like going to Moab and running for fucking 3 days. Yeah.
That's what I would do. I'd get people up at 5 a.m. on the farm in Vermont and they'd say, "Hey Joe, you said we were having a barbecue this weekend. Why do I have to get up 5 a.m? I said, "Well, we got to carry the barbecue to the top of the mountain." And they didn't know they were the ones being barbecued, but we had a lot of fun over those years. I did it for many, many years. And then that led to selling my business on Wall Street and focusing on building this company called Spartan.
And what's the, I guess, what's the ethos of the company? Like if you had a mission statement, I guess, what would it be?
Well, I didn't start out this way, but as I started seeing people come across the finish line with these transformative stories that I just described, it became, we want to change 100 million lives. And so every decision we make, anything we do, is the guiding light is, will it change lives? Will it change more lives? So it's a big, bold, audacious goal. It's going to be very, very hard to reach, but that's the goal. And so that's how we operate. It's, you know, whether the team stays late one night and waits for that last very overweight first time racer to come in, because it's going to change their life, or doing a podcast, or, you know, whatever we do, it's to change lives.
And how do you, this is kind of in the weeds, but how do you get somebody from the couch to the race? Cause you know, you kind of alluded to it earlier, but there are a bunch of different barriers to entry, from devices to the comfort of life. And then some people just don't know where to start. You know what I mean? I think that's a big intimidating factor for people who are, especially later in life, trying to get fit or fit again. They just don't know what to do. They remember the shit they did when they were kids, but that's not necessarily relevant anymore. So what kind of strategies do you guys have? Not just for, I guess, generalized motivation, but also articulating to them, like, you can fucking do this. It might take you some amount of time. The worse off you are now, the more time it might take you, but there, you can get there, right? Because it's pretty much anybody can do this.
Yeah, you know, if we owned a company that was putting on hockey competitions, I would say pretty much everybody can't do this. Like, pretty hard to strap on skates and learn how to skate and slap a puck on ice. But the reality is, as the species we are, everybody could climb, crawl, run, jump. Like, we can all do it. Mm-hmm. And it's very challenging to convince one person. Like, for 20 plus years, I've lied to people to get them to do these events because the human brain is designed to avoid discomfort at all costs. We don't want to expend too much energy. We want to survive as a species. So our brain says, oh, don't do that. That's going to require too much energy. Mm. Don't go to the gym in the morning. Don't get in that cold water. Don't eat that. Like, it's guiding us in the opposite direction we need to go. If this was the 1600s or the 1700s or 3000 years ago, that was a good fail safe mechanism we had in our head, right? Because life was hard. We might freeze to death if we went outside. We might starve to death, but that's not the case today. So trying to market and advertise to people that are inherently avoiding discomfort, that are staring at a phone, that have a climate controlled living room with Netflix, that is a tough fucking sell.
Yeah.
If I was selling handbags and M&Ms, it'd be a lot easier, right? But we're selling discipline, we're selling commitment, we're selling pain, suffering, like, tough sell. When people see the imagery, the videos, and they hear the stories and they see their friends, it gets people going. Yeah. It doesn't get 8 billion people going, but you know, we've had 10 million people do a race. I don't think it's ever going to be a market. There's just people just don't understand why they would even want to do something hard. It doesn't even make sense.
So I guess that's part of the challenge then, right? Is to explain to people why that makes sense. Now there's some people doing it. Rogan does it pretty well. Huberman does it pretty well. I mean, just from a physiological standpoint, but I think people know that. I don't think that's a mystery to people that if I eat better and work out more, I'm going to feel better and have a better life. I think people know that, right? And they still opt into the other side. We are animals for sure. And we have developed bad habits pretty rapidly since, let's say, the 1950s, probably, when the food pyramid came out, which was, yeah. That's another example of why not to trust governments. But yeah, that part, and then, you know, office life, working in the office. But we can definitely rewind. I mean, we've seen how quickly we've devolved into just a diabetic heart disease lifestyle. But it doesn't take very long to rewire the way your brain works. People think of it as a very daunting challenge, but generally speaking, habit forming takes 10 to 12 weeks of consistent effort. Not 21 days like some, you know, snake oil salesman used to write in their books, but about 10 to 12 weeks on average is what it takes. And in that very short amount of time, you know, you will feel quite a bit different. I think not just physically, but your emotional state becomes quite a bit better as well.
We have the secret weapon. And again, I don't mean to sound like a salesperson here, but I always think about Rocky I and then Rocky II. And it was intriguing to me at a young age that Rocky, he nearly won that first fight, or maybe it was the second fight that he beat Apollo Creed, and he had a lot of money and he had the house, and all of a sudden he started to relax. Mm. And that's what we do, right? We relax when we don't have a date on the calendar, when we don't have a fight coming up. But boxers, team, you know, other sports teams, billionaire, everybody starts to relax and become complacent. And what we do as a company is we put a date on the calendar for you. We put a fight on your calendar. And when that happens, those 10 or 12 weeks that you're talking about, they start kicking into gear because you're afraid. You're going to get your ass kicked. Mm. if you don't eat right, if you don't, right? So like that's what works. It's hard to have the discipline, the commitment. It's hard to change your habits if you don't have a purpose. You don't have something you're going. We have a wedding business in Vermont on our farm, and my wife and I always found it interesting that these brides and grooms, these future brides and grooms, would show up and they looked one way, and then a year later when it was time to have the wedding, they looked a hell of a lot better because they had a date on the calendar. They had to look good for the photos. So that's what we do.
I mean, just calendaring, like setting goals for yourself it's such an easy thing to do, you know? Even the New Year's resolution stuff, which I know never lasts for people for some reason or another, but I think you maybe make very more specific and realistic goals for yourself at New Year's. Like, I'm going to go to the gym for 20 out of the next 30 days or something like that, right? I think it's probably a little bit more helpful than I'm going to lose weight in 2024. Because that, what the fuck does that mean? That means you've got all the way until the end of the year to accomplish this very, I don't know, amorphous goal or whatever. You know what I mean? You got a book called 10 Rules for Resilience, and you cover a lot of stuff about this. And I like this book because something that I tell people a lot is, you know, we, for some reason, we've come to expect, and I think it's, you know, probably a function of our generalized comfort these days, but we've come to expect that life is going to get easier as it goes on. And it's just not true, right? I mean, we become more comfortable, but the truth about life is that the weight never gets lighter. You just get stronger, right? And if you're not doing those things to make yourself stronger, then the weight is going to get heavier and heavier, right? So tell me about this book, 10 Rules for Resilience, because I think it's one that people need to read. Because it's not just about the individual. It's about like how to make your family more resilient as well.
Yeah, it's a lot of the stuff you and I have been talking about. It starts with, you know, you got to know your why. You got to find your purpose, not just you individually, but you sit down with your family and teach your kids. Like, all right, why do we do this? What's our family crest? What do we believe in? And then just helps walk the whole family through this journey, or the reader through this journey on how to become successful, however you define success. Whether it's I want to make a bunch of money, or I want to be incredibly fit, or I want to be the best dad ever, or whatever that definition is for you regarding success, it explains and gives you the tools you need to get through the troughs, life's difficult periods where you're getting knocked down. And by the way, everybody's getting knocked down. And so the more tools you have, the more you understand the journey and the map, the more likely you're going to survive and come out the other side and be successful. About a year ago, we had a tough time, no surprise, as a company. When COVID hit, we got wiped out. We lost over $50 million. We had to borrow money from the government, the PPP. I mean, absolute nightmare. And I'm still fighting coming out of it now, just because we got shut down in 45 countries. About a year ago, the Wall Street Journal called, and they want to do a cover story in the bankruptcy section on how Joe is not paying his bills, not going to make it. And that's a low point. I mean, that's a tough phone call to get, because you're in a business where you're trying to give people confidence to get excited about a venture holding. And so it couldn't be a worse person to call me with a worse, you know, message. Mm. But I knew the book and I knew the journey. And I knew the trough, the deep trough, I call it the valley of death, that we all go into when we're going through something hard. And I realized that, oh, these are just the naysayers. Because when you're in the valley of death, let's say you're training for a marathon, or you're getting married, we go into this valley of death, and then the naysayers pile on and they say, oh, I told you not to run that far. You're too old and your knees were good. I told you not to marry that girl, right? I told you business was too hard. And so the Wall Street Journal was just a naysayer, and I dusted off. It was hard to do. I dusted off and grinded my teeth, and, you know, we got through the next day and the next day and the next day, and we're still here.
Yeah, I like what you said about just the goal setting part. Finding, I mean, we talk a lot about purpose on the show in many different ways, but it is something that, you know, it's relevant at the very small and very large levels as well. Like, no matter if you're planning the next hour of your life, or you're planning the next 20 years of your life, Eisenhower used to say that plans are nothing, but planning is everything. What he meant by that was that, another thing that somebody Patton used to say, like, no plan survives first contact, right, with the enemy. Of course, plans are going to change very rapidly as you run into life and circumstances and stuff like that. But the process of planning simply gives you a roadmap. But more importantly than the map is the direction, right? Because if you're heading nowhere, that's exactly where the fuck you're going. And, you know, we just kind of walk in circles a lot. We're comfortable at home. We like to walk in circles and every now and again, we'll walk a little bit farther outside of our circle. And if we run into any kind of resistance, we retreat back to the circle. And this is the first generation, I think, or the first, let's say, 100 years in human history where we've done that. And we're seeing the impact of that. And it isn't necessarily what you thought it would be, because kids are moving farther and farther away from home. I think the average distance, travel distance between an adult child and an adult parent in like 1950 was 14 miles. And now it's like 240 miles, right? So that includes people that live in the same town, plus people that are all over the country now. So it hasn't resulted in a closer knit family staying closer to home. We are more decentralized from our support and social systems than we ever have been before, but we are also risk averse at the same time. And maybe that's a function of one another. I've heard a lot of stuff about this. People talking about, like, if you're able to keep your entire family relatively close, like generational households, where the kids see the grandparents a lot and stuff like that. It seems to be that that's a quite a bit better solution if you're able to do it than, you know, just being spread out all over the place. I think there's that part of that purpose, that why, is reinforced every day by having the people most important right around you all the time. I think that's something that we've lost.
Yeah, as you were describing it, I was thinking back to my young age, even when I was running the pool business, being able to stop by grandma's house, by grandpa's house, grab lunch, grab a dinner, seeing everybody on Sunday, seeing, like, that was awesome. And even my family's lost that. We're in completely different places, but those are great memories. So I agree with you.
I wonder how we can't do that again. I mean, it's not going to happen on devices, obviously. And look, you know, we live in a different time, so maybe your industry doesn't exist near your parents or something like that, but we've got to figure something out here. We have to figure out a way to reestablish. I mean, it's like there's the stick and the carrot in life, right? We don't have the stick anymore, frankly. There's no wolves chasing us anymore. We've dealt with that particular problem. Existential threats pop up in the form of, you know, diseases and natural disasters from time to time, sometimes political disasters, but for the most part, we're pretty insulated from all that stuff. And the carrot has gone from, you know, good food to corn syrup, right? So we're fucked on both ends here. And something's got to be done about that. Like, we have to reevaluate what it is that motivates us, both stick and carrot. And there is no stick for the most part. So we have to be really conscious about the carrots we choose, right? Because right now we're on a pretty bad track.
They're pretty sweet carrots, and they're rotting our teeth.
I mean, they're just like rotting our teeth, giving us cancer, fucking up our hormones, diabetes, all this stuff. And it's, you know, I think a lot of the solutions to all these things are pretty similar. It's why I like a lot of the so-called self-help books, if you want to call them self-help, but like Jordan Peterson's books, I would say Greg Lukianoff books, your book on resilience, things like that. There's a lot of overlap between like family and your personal life and business as well. I think a lot of these principles apply kind of across the board there. And you've been pretty successful in business, and now you've got this show coming out on CNBC. You want to tell me about that?
Yeah. So the show on CNBC was, could we do this for companies? Could we take them, bring them to the farm in Vermont, beat the shit out of them, and in the process, shine a mirror in their face so they can see their problems? I think you said it best just a minute ago, where, you know, we tend to get into this, I don't know, this place where we're just doing circles. And we're complacent, and we might think we know the problems in our company, but we're not addressing them. And the farm attempts to expose them and bubble them to the surface and, you know, fix your company the same way we fix individuals or families.
And this was out in the spring of this year, right? I think, if I'm not mistaken. Is there going to be a second season?
We don't know. We don't know. TV is like catching lightning in a bottle. I've had, I think, 3 primetime television shows. The Rock took one of them from me, so we'll cross our fingers.
Yeah, I mean, it was a good show, so hopefully you can do it. And it's, I mean, I'm sure people that work in the business community have been involved in team building exercises before, but, you know, very low stake team building exercises, right?
Like
there's some low level risk of embarrassment for performance and lack of effort, I guess. But for the most part, you're not going to break a sweat in those team building exercises. I think it's important for people to break a sweat around each other. You know what I mean? There's something about putting a bunch of people, regardless of who they are, race, gender, all that bullshit, and letting them perform at something because a natural sorting happens, right? And not just a hierarchy, not just like, oh, this guy should be in charge and this person is obviously not fit for leadership, but like, this person is really good at this particular task. This person is really good at this particular task. In a business world, like, it's the same, and the same thing goes with being a coach of a sports team. Good coaches will, great coaches will put their people in a position to win, right? They will tailor their strategy to the roster that they have. And look, it's not a perfect world. You're not always going to have all the pieces you want. There's a finite amount of resources out there. But, you know, and it's the same thing with a military unit as well. In a perfect world, I want to have all the stuff I want. I'm not going to, because life is fucked up, right? So I got to deal with what I have. You can't make those decisions unless you know who people are, like really know who they are. And I think putting them through high stress, but relatively low consequence events is a really important way of figuring out who people are. That's why we put people through military selections.
Now, years ago, prior to Spartan being born, I would get a lot of Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, Merrill Lynch. They'd send me traders that were going to be handling hundreds of millions of dollars on a trading desk, and they'd send them up to the farm with me for a while to basically do that selection and find out, you know, how do they react? And so I agree with you 1,000%. And when you do it as a group, which again, we see every weekend somewhere in the world with one of our events, friends become humble. They get, well, you know, you get people together in a foxhole, you build bonds for life because all the bullshit goes away.
Yep. Pretense is gone. Yep.
Yep.
It's just like you strip everybody down to their core. And, you know, I think the bulk of it reveals character, but there's some character building that happens there as well. And it's just a function of sociology. People don't want to let down people they care about. And it makes you, I guess, in modern society, that would probably be the stick, right? That level of shame, like shame plays an important role in society. I don't want to let my people down. I don't want to let my family down. You should feel that fucking way. If you don't, you're a piece of shit, to be honest, right? Like if you're okay letting your family down, you're a piece of shit. There's no qualms about that in my mind. So
I agree.
You know, find that, put that behind you. Make that the fucking lion that's chasing you, because there's not a lion chasing you anymore. I think people could find a lot of motivation there, to be honest. But you got to be open to it. You got to be willing to feel bad about yourself and then overcome that feeling. Like, you know what? This is in my control. I feel bad about myself because I'm not doing what I'm supposed to do. That's what that means. Now I can do what I'm supposed to do and I'll feel fine.
I think that's the reason when they sign up for one of our events, that's the reason, the primary reason why they're eating healthy, going to bed early, training, right, is they don't want to be embarrassed. I used to say, you'll like this. We have a crazy race we put on every year on the farm called the Death Race. And it is selection. It is just badass torture. The goal is just simply to weed out the weak. And every year without fail for the last, oh my goodness, this thing's going on 20 years. The last 20 years, you know, a week before, 300 grandmothers all of a sudden die. People can't make it because their grandmother died. And so what I did was I said, you can't compete in this race anymore unless you get an article written in a local newspaper saying that you're doing this event, you're going to finish it. And all of a sudden, miraculously, grandmother stopped dying. Right? So, you know, when you're being held accountable and you're going to be letting people down, you're going to look embarrassed, you take things seriously.
Yeah. Yeah. I've heard a lot of my buddies that run, shooting camps and all sorts of other, you know, training camps and jujitsu and stuff like that started requiring a down payment. even if it was a small amount of money, like not so small that you would forget, but like $90, right? Something that'll register in your fucking brain. Just like, all right, cool. I got to go do this. I made a commitment. Here's my, cause you know, part of this new age, we make commitments. It's almost like when you're out hanging out with your buddies at night and you're like, hey, you know what? Let's get up and go work out in the morning. Nobody is getting up to go work out in the morning after you've been out drinking all night, you asshole. But that's the level of commitment. If you actually take that next step, right? Expose yourself to the tell people. This is something I like to say a lot. Say exactly who you are and what you want to be to in public to other people, and then do that thing, right? Like, force yourself into accountability, because otherwise, if there's any quit in your heart, you're going to quit. That's just the way it is. And some people are too dumb to quit, for sure. I know plenty of people like that. I'm not like that. I'll quit. If something stupid, I'll quit. But if you don't address that before you get there, if you go to selection, you're like, well, we'll see how I do. You've already failed, to be honest. Right. I'm gonna pass this if it takes me the rest of my fucking life. That's the attitude you have to have.
My favorite analogy, my favorite story around commitment. I don't know if you've ever heard of the marathon monks in Japan. Mm-mm. They've got a 25-mile trail. I spent a lot of time there, Mount Hiei, and they've got a 25-mile trail that they walk around each day praying with their wooden sandals on and their robes and their head shaved. And so if you and I wanted to become monks there, we would knock on the door and then we would say to them, we'd like to do this. And they'd say, great, shave your head, put on this robe, put on these wooden sandals, and you and I would do 100 days in a row of this 25-mile trek. And at the end of it, you and I would high five each other and say, that was awesome. We crushed it. We are now monks. And they would say, not so fast. We know you're committed now. Take this sword, take this rope. You have 800 more days to go. And if you decide to quit, you got to kill yourself on the trail. That's the kind of commitment we're talking about. Yeah. That's what I'm into.
That's pretty extreme.
I brought my family there. I showed my kids. You see the little tombstones of the people that killed themselves. I'm like, guy's a quitter. You know, you don't want to be a quitter.
Yeah, yeah. Cuyahoga. Hogia, maybe? Is that how you say it?
Oh, Mount Hiei. Yeah. I don't know the pronunciation of the monks.
Yeah, it's that's pretty extreme. There's a documentary on this somewhere. I can't remember. I've seen it before, but I can't remember where I watched it before.
Yes.
But yeah, that's, you know, you better want to be something if you're going to set out to do it, right? I mean, that's important. I was just talking to one of our buddies, Mickey Gall, is a UFC fighter. And there are some guys who like the idea of being something, and then some who actually love being it, right? And I think the more extreme something gets, the more you better love that thing or you're going to quit, right? Like these guys who are, or you're going to get hurt, I guess, in these circumstances. But like people who are like trying to fight professionally or climb mountains or something like that, and they're kind of half-assed into it, that's bad news, man. You don't want to do that. You don't want to be that guy who gets stuck somewhere or gets your head caved in because you're not doing the right shit.
You got to be all in. Yeah. You got to have the sword and the rope.
Well, speaking of all in, you've got Spartan races all the time, pretty much every weekend throughout the year, all over the world. Do you guys have anything big coming up, or is it just business as usual right now?
I mean, this past weekend, I think we had 5 events around the world. There's always something somewhere in the world. I like to say the sun never sets on Sparta, but we've got Spartan, we've got Tough Mudder, we've got all the endurance events. What I would propose to your audience is if anybody out there wants to do one of these events, no matter what, I'd love to have them all on the farm, by the way, at the end of June, but I'll take them anywhere. Just send you an email. And if you can collate and get a bunch of folks' emails, I'll give them all a free race on you.
Sure. Yeah, we'll do that. If you can, I'll make a social media post when this episode comes out and everybody can send me their stuff. It's a really good idea. I appreciate you coming on today and talking about all this. It's really good for the people.
Thanks for having me, and let's get that 1 year of service figured out in this country.
Absolutely. Thank you again for coming. I really appreciate your attitude and your expertise on these subjects. It's something that America is in dire need of right now. And thank you all for listening. This has been Citizen.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big on your Memorial Day barbecue, all in the Kroger app. Get 3-pound rolls of juicy 80% lean ground beef for $3.49 a pound with a digital coupon. Then get select varieties of flavorful Powerade, Body Armor Super Drink, or Arizona Tea for 77 cents each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.